the key element is that AI at scale becomes only efficient if there is a loop between gathering data, learning from the data and feeding it back to whatever is driving or creating data.
De Dataloog is de Nederlandstalige podcast over big data, data science, machine learning, kunstmatige intelligentie en de digitale transformatie. Luister naar onze wekelijkse podcasts, nieuwsupdates, specials en mini-colleges.
Yeah, welcome and great that you're listening to this episode of The Dataloog. It's still season 3 and I'm speaking English in a Dutch spoken podcast. What's happening?
We must have a very unusual and high priority podcast guest today, isn't it?
We make exceptions only for exceptional guests to stop speaking Dutch and switch to English. And that's because in this episode, we'll be talking with Daniel Gabler, the CTO of Picnic. Daniel, great to have you in this episode.
Thanks guys for having me. And let's see if I'm more on the unusual or on the exceptional side.
How is your Dutch, by the way?
Nou, gaat zo, een klein beetje.
Yeah, because originally you're from Germany, right?
Exactly. I'm born in Germany, raised in Germany, have seen a little bit of the world, have been also a bit in UK, US, ended up in Netherlands to do my PhD here. Like the people, like the country, and stayed here. Already since a little bit more than 10 years. So I should speak by Dutch by now, by the way.
And where did you do your PhD, Daniel?
I did my PhD here in Amsterdam at both the VU and the CWI in a topic that is both foundational computer science and data related, where I looked a bit in software correctness in a large-scale distributed probabilistic setting. So basically, if you build a large cluster systems that are deployed in multiple clouds, many servers, etc. I proved basic properties. So if you make a calculation, is it really guaranteed that it's correct or with which probability it's correct, etc. So cool stuff, which you can have a lot of fun. And at some point you earn a PhD, a little practical relevancy, by the way. But anyway, what's nice of it.
And so how many of your knowledge and your papers do you use in your daily practice at CTO at Picnic?
I think the concrete content of the paper is probably less, but the way of thinking, so applying the scientific method to go through a problem from what is the problem statement, or what are the, let's say, underlying driving factors of the problem, how can a solution look like, how do you compose different elements of a solution, etc. Similar to what the scientific method is about, that is something that you can apply very, very well also in today's computer science and data science.
And for those scientific listeners of us, Daniel has an H-index of 13 since 2016, and he has been cited more than 320 times currently. I'm now looking at your Google Scholar profile, of course. So not only he's a well-known exceptional guest, but he's also an exceptional scientist that makes a plus one again.
Yeah, is the good score you're in?
Well, he's twice as high as I am. I have 7 right now. So yeah, it's a good score.
Excellent. Thanks for promoting my research. maybe I can have 2 more readers. The funny part is that actually I finished my PhD in 2015 and my most active publication year is 2016. So where I really see that how long it takes that research gets published, because this is all stuff that I did a couple of years earlier.
So science isn't the next frontier, but Picnic is, of course. Yeah. So those of you who don't know Picnic, of course, have been laying on under a stone for the last few years. My first question would not be to you, Daniel, what is Picnic? But let's put it a different way. What makes Picnic stand out?
So maybe for those that are just zooming in or are not from Netherlands, so Picnic is an online supermarket that we started in 2015, and we are now active in 2 countries, have more than 1 million customers, etc. But the interesting part is that we are very much a mission-driven company that tackles one of the most exciting consumer opportunities in online food, and that is basically tackling 3 core challenges. On the first one is actually delivering not only food, but also healthy food. The second thing is applying a sustainable logistics system. And the third one is an efficient last mile. And especially the efficient last mile, where we developed a new distribution concept, which we call the milkman concept, is one of the key pillars that make Picnic very unique. And then from this kind of business proposition and operational proposition, we derived basically all the kind of technical architecture that is needed to make this kind of proposition becoming coming to life. And that's what we realized also early on, that is not only a tech game, but it's also a data game, and where you need to collect all kind of logistical and operational data to operate at scale in an efficient manner.
So in 2015, there wasn't this efficient last mile, a sustainable system of doing your groceries, or at least the last mile delivery, isn't it?
Correct.
We were really in a different world than we are right now.
And Jurjen, if I understood correctly, you were one of the first customers back then.
If I'm correct, Amersfoort was one of the first cities where Picnic started that time. And we were not even on the waiting list. We were just one of the first of them in the first pilot of the Picnic, indeed.
What was the reason for you to start using Picnic instead of going to the local supermarket?
I am all into the electric vehicle. So for me, the sustainability part was one of these first decisions that I made. The product portfolio wasn't then that much of a broad portfolio and in-depth of products. Well, really bulky products that they delivered. But I really liked these French wagons. They were, they were French products they had. And the interaction you had with the application was at that time, 2015, we're talking about right now, was excellent.
And you're still a customer today?
Yeah, twice a week.
Yeah, that makes Daniel smile.
Love it.
And Daniel, you were talking about these concepts that you introduced, right, to make this last mile efficient. You call it the milkman concept. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
So what we realized is when we were looking in distribution systems, and distribution and logistics is certainly something that exists since the early days of e-commerce, then there's two main differences that you can see between the traditional logistics systems or modern logistics systems. So the first one is, if you tailor a logistics systems to low-frequency buying, so that means, for instance, if you buy a books or electronics entities, then you distribute this in a very, very different way than if you need to distribute food. Because for food, you have frozen food, you have actually perishable goods. So therefore, you need to look in a very different way to your logistical supply chain. The second one is also that if you look to the existing system, so we looked a bit into what is existing in Netherlands, what is in Europe, what is in US, then everybody had such an expensive distribution system that they had to ask for delivery fees. So therefore, ordering food, which is typically just a few euro items, you had to pay significant delivery fees, which works for offices pretty well, doesn't work for private consumers. So that was the reason why in 2015, only 1 or 1.5% of all food was bought online. So therefore, what we did is we looked in this market and we identified and we thought, let's not tackle this 1.5% opportunity. So let's not think about what can we do better than the existing online proposition, but how can we convince the remaining 98.5% of customers to also move online? And then we basically identified that there are two key reasons why nobody was in a significant way doing from a private side ordering food online. And that is you had to pay for delivery fees and you had to wait quite long. So that means if you scrap this, if you deliver for free, and if you have much narrower time windows, so for instance, instead of 2 hours or 4 hours, you have 50-minute windows, then you can actually deliver to a much, much larger segment. That is something what we have seen in our first city in Amersfoort, and then in a few more than 100 cities now in Netherlands.
This sounds so easy, Daniel.
The funny part is that, and that is a very nice quote from Steve Jobs, it's very easy to connect the dots ex post afterwards. But in the beginning, it's obviously a lot of trial and error, and you just need to find out what works. And we have obviously done a lot of experiments that didn't succeed. So that is something where we need to, where we have also experimented a lot.
But this basic concept of no delivery fee and small delivery windows, that was there at the start. There was no pivoting from those core concepts.
No, because we knew that this will open up an entire new market segment. And that means if you actually move from a density, from the existing distribution density to a density that is 2x, 3x, 5x higher, then you get to a very, very different distribution cost efficiency. And that means if you're becoming more efficient in the way how you deliver stuff to customers, then you can actually give back this efficiency to customers by not asking for delivery fees. And that's exactly what we did.
At that time, Daniel, that you were setting up this delivery train, did you already do some simulations and case studies using data at the time? And do you envision the role of data in your daily business already?
Well, we obviously simulated a couple of logistical models because we also thought a bit about how many delivery moments do you need to offer per week or per day. We actually started with 3 delivery moments per week. And that is something where we knew that it is very efficient to do, but actually customers, this was not sufficient for customers. So that we knew that we had to actually deliver a little bit more often. Now we are delivering every single day. So that means 7 times per week, but only once per day. And that is actually the sweet spot where we see that this is attractive for customers enough, but also efficient and still with the distribution. But the early days, there was simply no significant data available to model this. So therefore, we just had enough simulation.
I can remember that at the time, indeed, that you have a Thursday, a Tuesday delivery, indeed, in Amersfoort.
Exactly. So we delivered in Amersfoort, and then we also went afterwards quickly to small cities around it, Leusden and Soest, and then we went to the next bigger city in Utrecht, and then the rest is history.
Let's zoom in a bit on the data side of things, because that's really essential to your business. But also, if we look at retail is becoming also a tech-dominated industry very quickly, not only because of the developments we've seen in the last year, but that has already been going on. And also with online groceries and data plays a vital role there, doesn't it, Daniel?
Certainly. So data is the driver of most of the innovation that is happening now in retail. And that is, but the interesting part is that many, many retail and logistics organizations have already a lot of data available. They have collected this over the last 10, 15 years, but most of them have not really found the right edge to use it in a successful way. So therefore, we designed our data strategy and our data concept in three phases. So the first phase was that we set up the key elements of data gathering and data acquisition. And that was basically the time from 15 to 17, where we thought a bit about what do we need to capture from the consumer behavior? What do we need to capture from the logistical behavior and fulfillment and distribution and route planning, et cetera, to really make meaningful analysis, to get meaningful insights on what works and what doesn't work. Then in the second phase, that was around 2018-19, we went into the phase where we really made deep dive analysis of all the data that we are gathering, really understanding which kind of concepts, which experiment we are working in, and which kind of insights can we gain from this. So this is a kind of a data valorization phase. And the third one, and this is exactly where we are now in, this is this kind of data-driven feedback and self-optimization loops, where we are taking data insights from a data warehouse or from an analytics database that we're feeding back on daily, but also sometimes on hourly basis, into operational systems that self-optimize. So a good example, for instance, is if you're delivering today in a city and we are realizing that to a customer when we're delivering there, that we need maybe a few seconds longer or we can even be a few seconds faster to deliver to this customer. Because if you're estimating how long does it take if we park there, the time from a parking position to the doorstep of the customer or from ringing the bell of the customer until the customer's at the door, etc., then we can take this into account in the planning for tomorrow. And therefore, the planning of tomorrow is more accurate. And that means it becomes a self-optimizing system where we, without any further software changes, by just doing more operation, the system becomes smarter and smarter and smarter every single day.
Wow.
That's for the delivery. And the customer has an app. He knows exactly where his groceries are and when they will be delivered. I hear you talk about seconds. Is it so that each second counts? Are you already optimizing on that kind of level?
You can express everything in seconds. And some seconds are a little bit longer and some a bit shorter. But in essence, in logistics, if you have a very high density distribution systems, then you realize that by just optimizing or just realizing that maybe some deliveries you can do a little bit faster, just 1 or 2 seconds, then if you do, let's say, 100,000 seconds, then you easily have gained another hour in distribution. So that is actually a very, very efficient way of optimizing a few hours of distribution. So it's a very efficient way of actually getting additional capacity out of the system. And that helps not only us from the efficiency side and Picnic, but also helps the customer, because that means we can even be more precise delivered to a customer. So in the app, you can also see in real time, when we are delivering there, what the vehicle, let's say how the vehicle is moving through the streets to the customer doorstep of the customer, but that is obviously also based on a forecasting that we have done before. So therefore, it becomes more accurate as we are doing more deliveries.
You mentioned these three phases of gathering data, analyzing it, then going deep and seeing where's the value of the data, and then building applications, getting feedback, and having self-learning algorithms. That's mostly for the distribution process, this milkman concept. Is this also applied to other areas of your business, like the distribution centers, for example?
So this kind of way of operating a data-driven business and a data-driven self-learning operation can be applied across the entire supply chain. So that is something what we are applying, for instance, to our fulfillment center and distribution centers, but also to our suppliers. So an example is, for instance, we are actually ordering with our suppliers just after the customer has ordered with us. But it means that that our suppliers need to know roughly how much we will order at the delivery, at the order moment. So therefore, if you're ordering, for instance, with Picnic bread, then until 10 o'clock, then we will, after 10 o'clock, just order from the bakery. But beforehand, we have a pretty accurate already prediction interval how much bread we expect to order at 10 o'clock from the bakery. So therefore, in hourly intervals, we give an expectation or a forecast to the bakery how much we expect. So maybe at 10 o'clock, we say, well, we need 1,200. But at 9 o'clock, we say it's maybe between 1,170 and 1,230. And at maybe at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it was even a bigger interval than it was between maybe 1,200 and 1,400. But this is basically the stuff that where we are not just making our supply chain smarter, but the entire supply chain from food producer to actual the end consumer.
You're mentioning that you're going beyond using predictions and machine learning for your predictions for your supply chain, but because you're using a feedback loop as well. It goes beyond using this simple AI algorithms, which is difficult for most companies in the Netherlands. So you're way beyond them. Could you elaborate a bit more on how did you go from using an algorithm to using a self-optimizing algorithm? What steps does it need to take to get there?
The key element is that AI at scale becomes only efficient if there is a loop between gathering data, learning from the data, and feeding it back to whatever is driving or creating data. And that is sometimes called, in marketing slides, flywheel of data. And that looks beautiful on the slide, but only very few companies actually can realize this kind of flywheel of data. But in the end, it is not so hard to do. The only thing what you need to realize is that you have a learning system that learns from operational data, but that is not only this kind of old-style data warehouse that is decoupled from operational system but never loops back to an operational system, but it is somewhere in between, which is still a kind of a semi-operational system that is fed from an operational system with operational data, so analytics data or other sensing data, and then also having a feedback loop then in regular intervals can be on an event stream, but also can be in a scheduled manner to the operational system to feedback optimized parameters. And that is something which we tried first in a very simplistic way, where we did, for instance, a stop time calculation, meaning how long will it take a stop at a customer. But then you can also go to a much more elaborate and much more complex scenarios where you're really getting into a loop of optimizing your algorithms based on a past operation.
For all of this, what you have built up, applications, a data platform, you must have quite an extensive team in-house as well. Can you tell a bit about your data organization?
You always look for data scientists, the smartest data scientists, and there's a shift in the industry. So we started a couple of years back that everybody was looking for this kind of PhD-educated data scientists that can go very deep on the deep learning and the machine learning algorithms, but that typically had more a difficult time to connect to the business modeling and the business problems. Then there was a shift more to business analysts that got educated in the machine learning and deep learning algorithms and that could at least train the algorithms. What we have found is that since there is still not a very... let's say, mature education of data scientists and machine learning engineers, you need to build those kind of engineers in your own organization. So what we typically have done is we have looked to smart analysts that have started, for instance, aerospace engineers, engineering in Delft or maybe in Eindhoven or some other universities, and then helped them to basically grow into the role of a data scientist in Picnic. But what we are actually looking for is not the classical data scientist, but to full-time, full-stack data scientists. And what I mean by this is data scientists that can actually make a business case, that can make the data analysis, but can build models, but can also actually, in operation, not only train, but also deploy models. So that is a pretty broad expectation profile for a data scientist. And it takes a little bit of time to build them up, but it makes them so much more productive. The biggest challenge that most companies have, and that is also something, if you look a bit into what makes AI in Picnic productive or effective, is the time to production is one thing, and then the time on how fast can you improve your models. If you can really 10x those kind of times, if you can bring a new model in production, not in a few weeks, but maybe in a few days, and if you can train this in a few hours instead of a few days, then you are actually really operating on a complete different skills than anybody else in your industry. And that is also the main difference between the classical GAFA type of companies that are already pretty mature on the machine learning side versus the rest of the industry.
I hear you saying that your data scientists, they basically can do it all. They prep data, they develop models, they wrap them in an API, take them in production, optimize them. Is that correct?
That is correct. And that is obviously a very broad profile. So not everybody can be an expert on all those angles. But what we're looking into in this... And this is the same trend as we have seen also in software engineering. So if you look a few years back, there were backend engineers, infra engineers, and then frontend engineers. What happened around 10 years back, people moved into full stack engineers, which was basically backend and frontend together. And then the DevOps movement made out of our full stack engineers also engineers that could do infrastructure. And the same is happening these days also in machine learning, that you have full stack data scientists or machine learning engineers that can model problem, that can train models, that can implement algorithms, but that can also operate it in production.
So it's just waiting now for the T-shaped data scientist then as the next wave.
And that has happened already to quite some extent. So we are talking already to candidates that are actually pitching this way. Not so much in Europe, but we see this very clearly already from the States.
Would you rather have, if we talk about T-shaped, then would you rather have a statistics-heavy data scientist or an engineering-heavy data scientist?
I think in the end, you need both. And you will only see, if you have two data scientists, one which is a bit more stronger on the engineering side, another one more on the business side, and both playing together, they can be most effective. What you see is that, in essence, you need both skills, but you need them to a different degree, along the life cycle of a data science or a machine learning project. So therefore, in the beginning, you have much more the explorative phase where you need to have strong business modeling and you're in the explorative phase to find out which kind of factors play actually a role in your problem. Later on, you're experimenting with all kinds of machine learning and deep learning algorithms. So there, it's more important that you have an engineering heavy AI and machine learning engineer. But in essence, you need both.
Does it mean that you don't have any data engineers or ML engineers in your team? Are they obsolete?
We have certainly also a full stack data scientist that are specialized more on the ML algorithms and more on the ML side. We have also data engineers that are actually focusing on the data engineering side of data science. So basically, data cleansing, bring data from A to B, etc. But in essence, we are looking into combining those roles in one combined role and just have the kind of the T-shaped profiles in a team together. And you have this also in software engineering teams where you have kind of full stack teams and bring everything together. And the same is happening here again.
And having these full stack teams, do you develop your own homemade algorithms? Do you make use of open source platforms and external models? Or do you use most advanced models yourself?
If you take a little bit of distance, then in the world of machine learning and deep learning, you have two types of companies. There's a relatively small set of companies that are really building a PyTorch and the kind of the underlying machine learning and deep learning algorithms and libraries. But that is typically a very deep techy type of companies. And then the 90% of the rest of the industry is applying those algorithms and patching a bit left and right. What we have done, we are definitely more on the application side of AI algorithms. We have done a couple of modifications to one of the bigger libraries to tackle one of the key problems that we have observed in the early days, which was about sparse data. So the point is, if you're operating logistics on Amazon scale, if you're operating advertisement on Google scale or Facebook scale, then you have usually always enough data if the rest of the industry doesn't. So therefore, sparse data is probably the biggest challenge that the rest of the industry has. And that is probably also one of the interesting open challenges that is still to be tackled.
Is this also something, what springs to mind here is, for example, with text recognition in English that works because there's a lot of English text, but for example, with Dutch, there's less of that. Could this sparse data be applied to those kind of domains as well?
To some extent. We obviously have also done quite a bit of NLP where we... use a pre-classification of feedback that we get from customers. For instance, we are trying to identify is this customer? So for two purposes, number one is identifying what is referred to, so which kind of products, which kind of categories, but also for sentiment analysis, because this is obviously something which is very interesting. If you have a super happy customer or if you have a super angry one, you want to react in a slightly different way versus somebody who is more neutral in this ways. So that is something where we see still quite a bit of potential, but basically the same algorithms as in English apply also to Dutch. So this is not a big difference, at least as we have seen it.
Those listeners were wondering, do you keep these technologies in-house? There's a lot of tools that you open source and experiences you open source on your Picnic website.
Correct. So if you go to picnic.tech, where we have actually open sourced quite a bit of the tools, we have also a pretty active blog, which you can find at blog.picnic.l. where you can find all kind of solutions that we have explored. And we are not shying away actually also to share the stuff that has not worked. Because what we learned along our journey is you can learn quite a bit of the stuff that has worked, but you don't want to be a copycat. The most interesting things you can learn is if you look into failures of others or what has not worked in other domains. What we see is that there are many, many interesting scenarios that have not worked for others, but that work for us. So therefore, I would encourage everybody to look also to the scenarios that have not worked in other domains, because there's typically a lot of thinking going in those kind of business cases before somebody tries something and it's not working. But then it may work for you in a slightly different scenario.
So Daniel, we have talked with a lot of companies about more data mature and AI mature. And one of these companies has these visions that everyone should have access to all data to make these projects work out. So how is it at Picnic? Is data siloed across your supply chain? Or is it do you have specialized teams within your projects? Or has anyone access to all data to do any project you would like to do?
So in Cent, we are following a centralized data warehousing model where we build a data warehouse that obviously with security and access rights, but where everybody has access to the data that is necessary and valuable for his kind of function or for his kind of role. We have by intention chosen for a data warehouse model and not for the a little bit more popular these days, a data lake model or a share lake type of model. For the following reason, said if you put in a little bit more effort and build a data warehouse, it is so much easier for the consumer, and you can enable such a larger user base to work actually with your data that it really pays off. So therefore, the classical Kimball modeling data warehousing is still a very, very, let's say, very successful model if you are in operation. So we are now around 150 engineers, but we have more than 200 analysts that are working from all kind of different domains with this data. And without too much coaching and training, they can work with all those models because they are very intuitive and modeling our business processes in the style schema data models.
And this data warehouse, is that cloud-based?
So for us, we are, as a company that started in 2015, we are completely cloud-based. So and we pride ourselves also to have everything in the cloud. Until 2018, we had really just cloud hardware. We hired actually two lawyers in 2018. Since then, we have also printer locally. But other than that, we had only laptops. We have more a very interesting case is we are actually now moving more and more in edge computing, where we are building a robotized fulfillment center, where we have all kind of robots moving around in a big warehouse. And if you make a robotic control, then the latency to a cloud hosting center is actually not good enough for the microcontrol that you need for the motors of a robot. So therefore, there is a part of the control software that is actually running locally. So we have a little bit of local deployment now, but the large part of the planning and the large part of the warehouse management is still in the cloud.
Are you using one cloud provider or are you using with multiple?
So we are we are AWS a shop. So we are using to a large extent the entire stack from Amazon. That has worked also pretty efficiently for us. Obviously, there's kind of dual, let's say, in a different deployment in different hosting centers for fail-safeness. But we are using Amazon pretty uniquely here. What we actually look into, and that is a very interesting cutting-edge case, is if you're making robotic control, then you get also to edge AI. So this is a kind of a new stream where you're trying to deploy actually AI algorithms or AI-trained models on the edge of your on-prem hardware. And that is something which we are still in the early stages, but I'm pretty excited about learning more and more about this, because the traditional model is that you train something in cloud and you move a trained model from the cloud to your on-prem hardware. But there are now also more and more algorithms that you can actually have also kind of on-prem hardware that you train on-prem. So that's very interesting.
And for AWS, edge computing is also one of the, you know, the bigger developments. They've introduced services like Outpost and Wavelength for infrastructure. Is that something that you're also leveraging? And do you see that AWS keeps up with the practical applications of edge computing?
So indeed, there is a service called AWS Outpost that allows to deploy a large part of the AWS services on-prem. We are not using it yet. We have another on-prem provider. But what we're doing is we're using all the virtualization on top of it, like Kubernetes, Docker, etc., that allows us to easily move between on-prem and cloud. And the infrastructure that we have set up is in a way that we can relatively easy move compute processes from on-prem to the cloud. So the idea there is that in essence, everything can happen in the cloud. But if there is kind of low latency requirements, then we switch over to an on-prem computation. Otherwise, it will be in the cloud.
For all listeners wondering, is what are the top three challenges in retail in your sector regarding AI challenges? So which we should focus up as a retailer?
Well, there's many challenges that actually retail is tackling these days. I think retail is relatively easy as long as things are running very smooth. Meaning, if you're not Christmas, if it's not Easton, if there's not an exception from food delivery, etc., then actually logistics and retail is not that hard. The trick with the hard part in retail is that is nearly never happened like that. So 80 or 90% of the year, you have exceptions. There's all kind of stuff happening. And that's the reason why there's the saying, retail is detail and retail is hard, et cetera, and logistics are hard, which means that handling all those kind of exceptions in a way that you can run also unusual or exception situations in a business as usual or in an organized manner is something what becomes very, very critical. So let me give you maybe two examples. So the first example is, if you're running a supply chain, then you get a lot of inbound deliveries from suppliers, but they are late, the driver is maybe moving to a wrong warehouse, he brings the wrong quality, the wrong quantity, there's all kind of stuff happening. And if you get on a daily basis a few hundred deliveries, you can expect that at least two or three deliveries are not okay. So you need to build significant resilience in a system that is still not eating in your efficiency, but on the other hand, makes basically not lifts this kind of unusual behavior towards your customers. So the expectation from the customer is that you always get best quality and complete deliveries. But no supplier can ever tell you that I always deliver a full best quality and always complete. So therefore, you need to build up enough buffers in between to cope with such a situation.
Can you give an example of such a buffer, Daniel?
So the buffer that you are typically building is that you build either logistical buffers, meaning you order a little bit more, or you have a kind of a chain of supplies that you have alternative deliveries, that you maybe order from multiple suppliers, that you have backup suppliers, that you have also additional quantities or substitutes available that are close enough for a supplier that you can also at least deliver to a customer that you're not missing this item.
Which is easier for non-perishable goods, I suppose.
That is definitely in some categories easier. For non-perishable, it's definitely easier to have bigger quantities. For perishable goods, you can't. There's a limit to how many items you can have there. It's also replacement is not that easy. Just think a bit about if you are replacing, for instance, meat, you can just use it with the same category, even if you have there quite a few limitations. But the even more interesting kind of second example I wanted to bring is that if you look to a bit the channels where customers are buying goods, that there was obviously a movement from offline to online and then from desktop to mobile. And what is happening now is that it becomes even more diverse, that more and more are ordering not only mobile, but also starting to order over voice and other channels. So there's a kind of a new direction of this of retail where it becomes not clear what is actually the next major trend. So some people are going conversational commerce, which is basically saying that over, for instance, a chatbot or over a chat interface, you're buying stuff, or maybe over voice or other interfaces. But that is also a little bit foggy. So therefore, the entire industry is trying to look into what is the next big thing in retail. And to be frank, we have also not figured out completely what it is. We have done a voice a prototype, which looks very interesting. And we had a lot of fun from the tech side. Actually, consumer-wise, this is not it's not really relevant these days. But we will see what comes next.
And from a supply chain point of view, can I understand you? You say there's the planning, there's all kind of incidents, and there's your seasonality. Can you learn an algorithm? Can you train an algorithm from Eastern to work out in Christmas? Is there a learning or transfer learning component in these algorithms that you're trying to implement?
So you work essentially on three levels to handle those kind of exceptions. So the first one is that you have a year prediction, meaning that you are taking the exceptional behavior that you have seen the year before to the year later. So that means an Eastern from a year before looks roughly like the Eastern year the year later. For Eastern, it works pretty well because it is on the same calendar days. For Christmas, that is an issue because in Christmas is on different calendar days. So therefore, you cannot easily transfer this. The second one is you see roughly the same type of special patterns over the that for Eastern, for Christmas, and a couple of other special events over the year that you can where you can make transfer learning between the models that you have used for Christmas and also to the Eastern model. And then the third one is, and it's a very kind of straightforward approach, that you apply a special margin just for those kind of events where you just need to have a bigger, higher hour margin.
Like a hot day and having the barbecue in the freezer and then putting your products online, isn't it?
Everything what is reasonably predictive you can do in this way. And also if there is at least a kind of a trend that you can see, for instance, if you have a heat that is not coming from one day to the other, so that is building up a little bit. If you have really exceptional events, as an example, the COVID situation, when everybody, normally you have roughly 0.5% of the orders have toilet paper. If you move from 0.5% to 50% of all orders have toilet paper, then you have a kind of, then you're lost in your model and you just need to start from scratch again.
So that's what I'm heading for indeed, planning for the unplanned. So we've got the seasonality, we've got the incidents, we've got the hot summer, and then comes COVID. Here you go. There are your self-learning algorithms, your deep learning time series. How did you manage?
It's actually a very good question. I think we are applying two methods to this. The first one is we are monitoring latent behavior and we are trying to extrapolate a latent behavior. So what you see is, for instance, with sustainable food or with special eating patterns, that they start with a very, very small minor trend. At some point, it incrementally just become bigger. And it's a bit like that you have this compounding effect. It starts with 0.1% of your customers do it, and then 0.2, and then 0.4, and then 0.8. And it's still relatively small, but you see already a kind of a significant buildup. And then you go from 0.8, you go to 1.6, and then you moved to 3.2, and then you are at 6.4, etc. So if you early on identify those kind of latent patterns and latent trends, then you can also relatively easy predict this kind of major disruption that happened at a later stage. The other one, and that is not so much data science related, but this is more kind of agile software development and kind of modern software development related, is you need to build a system, an engineering organization, but also an operation that can very quickly react to unexpected behavior. So it is, many companies try to be outsmart in a kind of trends in the sense of trying to predict whatever may happen. Sometimes it's much easier for a business just to faster react to the unexpected or unpredictable behavior instead of trying to really predict stuff that is very, very hard to predict.
The turmoil around the COVID-19 and the lockdowns, so not the actual virus itself, but everything that happened around in the society. Do you see that as a blessing or a curse for your business?
So there are two trends that we have seen in the early days. On the one hand, there is a really massive increase in consumer demand, which is nice because actually, if your goal is to make as much as possible a customer happy, more customer want to be happy. So then that is nice. But if on the other side, supply chain is very much under pressure, especially your suppliers have a hard time to deliver the right quantities, the right qualities on time to you, then you are in a very difficult situation. And that is something where I'm a little bit torn in if it's a kind of a curse or a blessing. So it is probably both to some to different kind of extents. These days, what we see now, and it is a bit kind of the aftermath seeing now 1 year or a little bit more than a year of COVID, we see that what COVID has done is, if you take maybe the first 4 to 6 weeks away, it has accelerated a process that was already happening there. So we have seen earlier this kind of latent trend to that people move to shop for food online. That has accelerated massively. We are also very realistic that not everybody who has tried it now during the COVID period will continue to do so. But we see a very significant amount of customers that could go relatively easy now again to a physical supermarket, continue to do online shopping. And that is something which is pretty nice. And if you look now to a bit, for instance, to China, where we reached last year, actually the first time that in entire retail, 50% was e-commerce. So e-commerce has a share of 50%. It's crazy if you think a bit about. We are far away from this in Europe and US. So Europe is around 20 and US is around 30% or so total. If you look to food, we are in Netherlands now, I think 4 or 5%. So this is relatively small, but you can see that there is a trend that you can relatively easy extrapolate. It is not unreasonable to assume that food goes also to double digits numbers.
At the same time, COVID hit and you're scaling up still your business. So the regular business also continues. I read in the newspaper that you're opening a new distribution center. Perhaps that's the one that you referred to as well. It's on the spot in the Netherlands. It's in the core of grocery land. What kind of impact does opening a distribution center have on your data and analytics practice?
Since a year ago, over the last year, we have actually opened in Netherlands 3 or 4 fulfillment centers and in Germany also 2. So that is actually an ongoing process. But indeed, we are opening also soon again one additional one. What is happening when we're opening a new fulfillment center is essentially 2 things. Number one is we're setting up all the systems that we can operate such a fulfillment center, and we apply transfer learning, basically all the best practices that we have learned from an earlier fulfillment center to this fulfillment center. Because the goal is very simple. The first fulfillment center that we launched in 2015, it took us more than a year until we launched the second fulfillment center. And from the second to the third, it was half a year. And we are basically going further and just moving further, halving the launch time of a new fulfillment center by applying transfer learning, both on the tech and the data side, but also on the operation side and operational principles. And the hard part is that on the one hand, you can relatively easy apply transfer learning for data and technical processes, but you need to apply the same also for business and operation processes. So that means if you have a kind of a new launch team there that has not worked in another fulfillment center before, then you need to also train them that they can work with this kind of trained models from another fulfillment center.
Daniel, we're heading for the end of the podcast right now. And you, as CTO of one of the most advanced retail companies, at least in the Netherlands, do you have a recommendation for all those retailers that are catching up now during COVID times and to get their data and their algorithms done in place? Could you give a one-shot recommendation for them to catch up at least a bit during these COVID days?
I have 2 recommendations. So one and a bonus one. The straightforward one is, I think everybody should stay very much open-minded for all the emerging trends. And what I mean by this is it's relatively straightforward that you should apply data science and machine learning. You should apply the latest retail technology. But these are no longer emerging trends. These are realities that everybody in the retail industry applies. What I would encourage everybody to watch out for those trends that are still super tiny, where you have a couple of scrappy startups that are experimenting with it and that have really significant potential to bring retail one step further or a couple of steps further. This is one. And the second one is, while everybody should use data as much as possible, and in this podcast and in your audience, and we all love data, obviously, you should stay very, very critical also what data can tell you and what data can what say about the world. And what I mean by this is the following. I think with data, we can derive something and we can extrapolate existing behavior, but the kind of the hidden story behind data is something that only you with your human mind, with interpretation of data, can actually add to the story. And I think that is a very, very important lessons learned that we also saw, where we tried on our side just to extrapolate data without really understanding what we have seen there. And that is something what usually is not leading to big success. And the stay critical part is also said, without challenging yourself about what could you really achieve if you would rethink fundamentally a new concept, as we have done this with Picnic and a logistical concept, but there's many, many more possibilities. You can sometimes achieve even more by just optimizing a system based on data. So therefore, you should have always a kind of a healthy split between the kind of incremental improvements that you make data-driven, but also the moonshots and the roof shots, which are typically more of qualitative nature. We are really going for the next level.
Great. Daniel, thanks a lot. And as a company, you are quite open. You really support the open source community. You contribute and you share a lot of insights from the trenches. Well, that is obviously by choice. What's the underlying reason for doing that?
We're using a lot of open source. So therefore, we are standing off shoulders of giants of the open source community. So therefore, we feel also obliged that we give back to the community the stuff that we are developing on the software side, but also on the data technology side. On the other hand, if you look to a modern company, then actually the software stack that you're building is something that will not make the difference. It's typically the data and also the way how you set up your data processes. So therefore, data and data processes are the real asset of a company. And you could, most companies would probably not lose any value by just open sourcing the entire software stack that they have built.
Well, that's another valuable tip I think we get for free at the end of this podcast. And sharing knowledge, that's what you did also in this session. Daniel, thanks so much for sharing your insights, your experiences, and being so open about developments at Picnic.
Thanks, Walter. Thanks, Julian. Thanks for having me. Thanks, everybody out there.
Really great pleasure to have you in the podcast, indeed. Wow, what a vision.
Thanks for listening. And we hope that you will stick with us and listen to the next one as well. See you later.
Bedankt voor het luisteren naar deze uitzending van de Dataloop. Vond je onze podcast leuk, goed, interessant of wellicht te veel enen en nullen? Laat een review achter of geef thumbs up. Heb je vragen of opmerkingen? Kijk dan ook eens op www.dedataloog.nl. Hier staan ook de show notes van alle uitzendingen. Je vindt onze nieuwe uitzendingen wekelijks op iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify en alle andere bekende podcastplatforms. Alles wat we maken doen we onder Creative Commons. Je mag alles hergebruiken voor niet-commerciële doeleinden, zolang je ons als bron maar noemt. Volg ons op Twitter op @dedataloog. Graag tot de volgende keer en voor nu, tot data!